October of 1945, more than 200 Jewish prisoners were rescued from a British-run internment camp set up in Palestine after World War II. Their crime? Being an illegal immigrant. Hello, I'm Valerie Jackson, and today I'm going between the lines with Anita Diamond. Her novel, The Red Tent, was a New York Times bestseller. She's a prize-winning journalist and the author of 6 books about contemporary Jewish practice, a collection of essays entitled Pitching My Tent, and 2 other best-selling novels in addition to The Red Tent. Her latest novel is Day After Night. I'm delighted to welcome you today, Anita Diamond.
It's great to be here, Jim. I'm thrilled to meet you, Valerie.
Thank you. Day After Night is the story of 3 months in the lives of 4 women, refugees from Nazi Europe. These women were detained because they were illegal immigrants into Palestine, and many of these immigrants were fleeing to Palestine as a result of something called the Palestinian Mandate. Explain what this mandate was exactly and how it impacted the immigrants.
Okay. Well, the British were in charge of running Palestine. It was a League of Nations, United Nations decision that had been made in the 30s. And so the British were stuck with this difficult situation of mediating between the Palestinian Arabs and the Jews who were moving to Palestine, fleeing persecution in Europe. So at the end of the war, there were quotas in place for the number of immigrants who were allowed to come in. But there were far, far more people who needed a place to go. There was nowhere else in the world who was eager to accept these immigrants. And so they fled to Palestine, where they were confronted with the fact that they weren't supposed to be there statistically. So the British would arrest them, intern them, and then, for the most part, though, let them go. Some of them did have some documentation, some papers, and in other cases, they just sort of processed them and let them into the country. They had made it to Palestine at that point, so they sort of were in a holding pen for a little while. What was frightening was that it was a barbed wire facility again, and they were re-traumatized, some of those right. people who'd seen enough barbed wire right. in their lives.
Especially those who might have been in concentration camps
exactly.
earlier.
Exactly.
It's very hard to distinguish between the two. But why don't we try to do that? Talk about the difference between a concentration camp versus this internment.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, this was a holding pen. I mean, the concentration camps were death camps, and people were there, in some cases, to work briefly or to be worked to death. And those who weren't strong enough to work were put to death immediately. Actually, most of the concentration camps were simply death camps, but this was not that. And people were reassured relatively quickly that because they were given food to eat and they were given clean clothes, and people started asking them where they were going, where they wanted to go to, where their families were from, and they were really attended to. Medical care was available to them too. So although there was a kind of trauma in reaching this camp, and in fact there were boxcars from Haifa where a lot of people were detained, which was a major port. Some of these people were put in boxcars and sent the 3 or 4 miles south the coast to Atlit. Again, boxcar journeys just re-traumatized people who'd been put in boxcars on their way to Auschwitz and right. internment camps. So it was terrifying. And yet at the same time, they were being reassured that, no, you're okay. You're not going to be hurt here. We're going to take care of you. You're going to be fed. So there was this terrible dissonance between what they were seeing and what they were being told at the same time. It's so poignant, and it's so hard to imagine what must have been going through these people's minds at that time.
What was the relationship like between the Palestinian settlers who were working at the internment camp and the survivors that were there?
Well, the camp was run by the British with soldiers. So there were men with guns and mm-hmm. sentry towers. But there were people from the Jewish community in particular who were there to try to resettle people, to teach them Hebrew, to feed them, to get them acclimated, and try to process them into this life. So they were an interesting group of people. They were dedicated and passionate, but they were also, at least in my retelling of them, a little eccentric as well. They were used to living a very different life. So you had people who'd been in Palestine living in this very hot climate and speaking Hebrew and living a life so different from those of European Jews. So in a way, they were very exotic to each other, even though they were co-religionists and that there were natural affinities. They also, there were divides there that they had to overcome.
As a matter of fact, you said that you got varying stories, different stories about what actually did take place. How diverse were the stories?
They're actually, it's what's remarkable in a way, Valerie, is how few firsthand accounts there are of this period. I think people were not encouraged to speak about what had happened to them. Better to move forward, put it behind you, swallow hard, just into the future. But there are some accounts. I interviewed a few people as well, and some people spoke about the trauma of that barbed wire. Other people talked about the food and how welcomed they felt. Some people talked about the dissonance, but the other thing is that a lot of these accounts were from very, very young people. They were 15, 16, 20 at the most. And so their memory, these are incredibly resilient human beings. We are, as a species, a resilient creature. And so people fell in love in this camp. People learned languages, learned different languages.
Well, that's certainly a difference from the concentration camps.
Absolutely, yes.
Right.
Yes, that men and women were... actually, they were kept separate, but not so separate. They ate together. And after all that terror and after all that hunger, being fed again, starting to be able to sleep through the night at the age of 15, 16, 17, that's sort of nature takes its course.
Well, let's talk about the main characters that you focus on in the book. Let's start with Shandel. Very interesting character. I liked her. Polish heroine, if you will. Yep. Tell a little bit more about her.
She's a very young woman also. She was a partisan fighter. So she was fighting against the Nazis in the forests outside of towns in Eastern Europe. And she learned to fire a gun. She had been a Zionist as a youngster. She went to summer camps. This was pretty common in Europe, who had the dream of moving to Palestine someday and living as free people in a Jewish state. So she had that in her mind. But she lost her brother who went off to join with the partisans and was killed and winds up being the only surviving member of her family as well. Survives the war in the woods with a small band of other partisans whom she loves dearly, who she also loses, and again becomes the sole survivor of that group, finds her way onto a leaking, creaky boat, which is how people made it from Europe to Palestine, and starts again, yet again. And while people see her as a heroine, she's carrying around this sense that if only I could have been a better shot, perhaps I could have saved my friends. If only I had been a faster runner, perhaps I could have prevented somebody else's demise. So all of these girls, and I think all survivors, carry around a kind of guilt about what could I have done? Why am I here? Why am I the one who survived this when my brother would have been so much a better pioneer here in the land of Israel? Why him not? Why me not him?
It struck me how she kept reaching for the gun that she used to carry over her shoulder, but of course it's not there anymore. But like we always get out purse strap, we're always adjusting the strap, and sometimes we do it when the purse isn't even there.
Exactly.
And I
exactly.
could see her reaching for that rifle.
Gun, yeah, right.
In spite of all that, though, she was probably one of the most cheerful, residents in the camp. Let's talk about, is it Leonie?
Yeah.
Leonie. The Parisian beauty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Parisian beauty, who in many ways is the most damaged, although you could argue that Zora also is very damaged. But Leonie was actually pressed into prostitution in Paris for a few years, and she was very beautiful, very young. She was probably 15, 16, and was basically kidnapped by a neighbor after her other members of her family had been turned into the police by other Parisians. And so she's carrying around this horrible, dreadful secret of how she survived the war. And it's a secret that doesn't ever get told, never. Mm-hmm. And I think that we all know that horrible, dark secrets like that can eat away at the soul and destroy the future for you on some level.
They all had secrets.
Mm-hmm.
Teddy, tell us about her and her secret. She hid out on a bond for a couple of years.
Yes, she was in hiding. She's Dutch, certainly the most famous Dutch Holocaust victim was Anne Frank. And like Anne Frank, this character is sent out of the city, out of Amsterdam, to the countryside to hide in a barn with some farmers who don't treat her well in the long run. They're not family friends. They're people who were probably paid something to, mm-hmm. to hide her. And she's also assaulted by the father and son of the family and is ultimately turned in to the Germans. But it was late in the war, and she was lucky. That word gets thrown around a lot.
Right.
And did escape from a train that was taking her to a concentration camp. But it was very late in the war, and she's actually picked up by soldiers, British soldiers, and also like the others. Although she wants to go back to Amsterdam, unlike other people, Amsterdam was a place of beauty and love and support. And only when she finds out that her family perished does she decide, I can't go back there. Where can I go?
Right.
And there are other people around her saying, well, come with us. Come with us to Palestine. And she goes.
Quite a few of them couldn't go back home because,
right.
For instance, over in Poland,
mm-hmm.
you know, if Chantal had tried to go back there, she would have found herself being, you know, rejected, mm-hmm. discriminated against.
People were killed. Jews were killed when they went back to Poland. I mean, the Polish, there is unfortunately a long history of anti-Semitism in Poland that has nothing to do with Germans and National Socialism. And they were not happy to have the Jews coming back. And there were many documented cases of people being killed and of being chased away. And there was no going back
right,
in Poland.
Right. Well, you mentioned Zora mm-hmm. earlier. Zora mm-hmm. was the one who had been in the concentration mm-hmm. camp. Bitter, angry, mm-hmm. and rightfully so.
Yeah. She also is the character who brings up the subject of religion and how does one maintain faith after having seen the worst that a human being can do to others and how low people can be cast. And for her, she was somebody who grew up in a synagogue and learning and learned in a way, for a girl in particular, but she can no longer stomach people praising God's name or praying. To her, that's just it's blasphemy because life has become meaningless as far as she can see. Mm-hmm. And she really cuts herself off from not just from the sacred, but from other people. And it takes her a while to find a way to connect again, whether she finds a way to connect again. The divine, I don't know here, but I don't want to give away too much.
Right.
But she is moved by other people finally. But it takes a long time because life has treated her very badly, and there is something in her that is broken, mm-hmm. really broken.
Mm-hmm. Unlike the Red Tent, where secrets were shared mm-hmm. like bracelets,
mm-hmm.
and for those who are not familiar with the Red Tent, it's a wonderful novel about, you could probably say it a little bit quicker than I could.
Well, The Red Tent is a retelling of a biblical story entirely from the perspective of the women. Dina is the daughter of Jacob and Leah, and she's the only girl among the 12 sons, the 12 tribes. And so this is the story from her point of view. And in the Bible, it seems to be a story of rape. I've retold it for her being a young woman who finds love and circumstances far beyond her control take her away from her family, from her life, and from her beloved. And it's a story that really does celebrate women's relationships, especially within this family, this extended family of four mothers.
In the environment of the red tent, where they were isolated from the men, and they did get to talk with, you know, their sisters and nieces.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, they shared the secrets. And day after night, though, the women were all very hesitant mm-hmm. and kept their secrets close. Was it because the secrets were just too horrendous to speak about?
I think so. There really was a culture of not talking about these things. In a funny way, I think we live in a time where we're so used to the memoir and the confessional and therapy and the talking cure. And this was a time, and until recently, that wasn't the case. And in this was a time, it was such unspeakable horror that people went through, and there was great shame.
Right.
A character like Leonie was covered with shame,
even though it wasn't her fault.
It wasn't her
right.
fault.
Mm-hmm.
But we all know that victims often feel that somehow they are responsible, that it's their fault that they've been enslaved, or that they've been abused, or they've been assaulted, and so it's kept close to the vest, and also the people around them were ashamed. And they, you know, why couldn't we have stopped this? Why didn't we do more? So there was this big conspiracy of secrecy and shame. And it really wasn't until 1961, I think it was, and the Eichmann trials were these big public trials of one of the great war criminals of the Nazi era, that people started telling their stories after that. It kind of opened the floodgates.
Well, I had a piano teacher for my two daughters for about 9 or 10 years. And she was from Russia. She was a Russian Jew. But I never knew until just recently when her son wrote a book about how she had to hide and escape from the Nazis and survived by passing as a non-Jew and playing the piano. Mm. And it was so, but my point was she never once talked to me in 10 years about that horrendous part of her life. To this day, her sister still does not speak.
It's still true. It's still very, very difficult in many families. My parents were both Holocaust survivors as well. And it's, you know, I have the outlines of stories, but it was too painful. It was too painful. I remember as a child walking into the kitchen and seeing my mother and grandmother weeping. And then they would stop because it would upset me. So then the curtain would come down and that's not unusual. That's pretty typical. I think it's not just specific to this one part of history that if you have had a loss that causes shame in you and you don't want to burden the next generation with it. So we're all protecting each other on some level, too.
Well, if you've just joined us, I'm Valerie Jackson, and we're going between the lines of Day After Night by Anita Diamond. Anita is the best-selling author of the novels The Red Tent, Good Harbor, and The Last Days of Dogtown. She's the author of 6 nonfiction guides to contemporary Jewish life and is an award-winning journalist whose work has appeared regularly in the Boston Globe magazine as well as Parenting. I didn't really get the gist of the title. Explain the title. Why Day After Night? I think I know where you're coming from, but tell me.
Well, it took a long time to come up with this title. I have to tell you, we struggled with it. Titles are tough. Sometimes you know right away what it's going to be, but The Red Tent was not the title of The Red Tent while I was writing it. It was going to be something else. And here it's the idea that the day follows night. It's not night after day. It's that there's a morning after the sun comes up in the morning after even the darkest night. And life goes on. And life is relentless and creation is relentless. And even if you are broken and shattered, it's going to pull you into the future. Life will carry you forward. And some people, but one of the reasons I wanted to tell this story from 4 different perspectives was that not everybody comes through it whole. Not everybody comes through in one piece. Some people are truly damaged and cannot forgive, cannot move forward, cannot make the connection to fully love and embrace life. And others with similarly horrible experiences can, and in fact become remarkably loving, open, forward-looking people. There's no predicting.
You know, for some in the book, I think, when they thought about what they had lost, it became the thing that really kind of kept them going. You know what I mean?
Yeah, memory, the need to honor the memory of the people who've gone before you who can't live. So to live for one's brother who passed away, to live to make the parents who won't see you succeed, to make them proud, to carry forth the things that you were taught. And so I think that can become a source of strength and inspiration, even in loss.
Now, there was an escape. Obviously, the escape was planned, and the 4 characters we just talked about all played a part. But the members of the, is it called Palmach?
Palmach.
Palmach. These were the, they later became the Israeli military.
Right.
Is that correct?
Right.
Okay. There was, if I'm not mistaken, among that group, a man that we all know quite well, as a matter of fact, a Nobel Prize winner, and later went on to be the Prime Minister of Israel.
Right, Yitzhak Rabin, a very young, very handsome, if you see the pictures of him at the age of 19 or 20, dashing young man, was one of the party. It was a large party who were sent by the Palmach, who were the sort of the armed part of the Jewish settlement in Palestine, to rescue the people in the camp because there was word that they were planning to repatriate some Jews from Iraq and Syria. And had the British sent them back, they would have been killed. Mm. So the Palmach decided this could not stand. So on October 10th, 1945, there was a kind of commando raid, and they took all 200 prisoners out of the camp in Atlit and took many of them up the mountain right to the east of there, the Carmel, and escaped, and with almost no casualties at all, which was the goal. They didn't want to re-traumatize these people. There was very great care was taken that nobody should be hurt. The only casualties, which happened far from the camp, actually was a driver and also a British, a young British officer who were killed in crossfire. But none of the prisoners was harmed, and the guards at the camp were knocked out and tied up. So it was a very dramatic rescue. And it was the first time, actually, though, that the Jewish community had attacked the British directly as occupiers. So it was a kind of change in tactic from before the war. And the presence of these illegal immigrants galvanized the whole Jewish community there, because Jews are notoriously argumentative.
We disagree
about everything amongst ourselves. But this was something that unified the community, that these people from Europe, these brothers and sisters from Europe, should have the right to return here because there was nowhere else for them. Why not? And that unified the community in a way, and there was nothing but support for this action.
In the internment camp, there were a lot more men than women. Mm-hmm. Well, why was that?
Well, this is one of those horrible things that I hadn't known until I did the research for the book. The Nazis killed women faster than they killed men. Men were marginally more useful to them alive. They killed, of course, millions of men as well, but men could be worked to death in a way that women weren't. So women were killed faster. And so there were fewer women in Atlit. There were fewer survivors after the war. There were fewer women in Europe in the displaced persons camps as well. So there was a kind of a lopsided ratio between men and women and boys and girls.
Well, in spite of the gruesomeness of the camp, singing and dancing, mm-hmm. they were still singing and dancing and having ceremony around food. As a matter of fact, on the cover of the book, mm-hmm. you have women dancing. Why was that a theme? Do you think that actually was something that helped them to survive in the camp?
I do. And there are, if you go to Atlit, where you can, it's sort of a living museum. It's a place that school children are taken.
And you've been there.
I was taken mm-hmm. there because when my daughter was 15 and she was spending a semester in Israel as a student, we went to visit, and we went on her field trip to Atlit with her, which is where I found out about this. I was talking to my daughter last night, and she said, "Boy, you remember this much better than I do." And I said, "Yes, but I've been working on this for a few years, too." But even when you go to Atlit, there are photographs on the walls in the buildings, and you see people dancing. They tend to be men. They tend to be young men with their shirts off, wearing shorts, with their arms around each other, grinning ear to ear. But there are some girls, too. But there are also pictures of girls looking out quietly. So I was intrigued about the untold stories of girls. But singing and dancing, folk dancing, learning the folk music of Jewish Palestine, and some of those songs were brand new. They were not like ancient songs. They were new minted songs. It was a way of expressing hope and faith in the future, and it's a form of affirmation, not unlike prayer. It's not religious in a kind of service kind of way or liturgy kind of way, but there is in it, I think, a profound affirmation of the goodness of life in that, and it's also communal. You know, it's something you do with others, and it gives you strength.
Right,
singing and dancing with others is a source of strength.
And of course, we have to keep in mind too that most of these young people were like teenagers, so
right?
they were still able to be resilient mm-hmm. and hopeful.
Right.
So the combination probably helped a great deal.
Absolutely.
I want to ask you a few personal questions, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. One is a very silly one. I noticed we shared a love of Mary Poppins.
Oh, yes. When people ask me my favorite books, and I always bring up Mary Poppins.
Do you know, I always think of her too, but I'm always shy to say it because people say Mary Poppins. You know, like why? But there was something
about
this.
Now you can say it because of Harry Potter. Now we can compare, because she was a witch
mm-hmm.
and she was in London, and she had this sort of alternative London that she took the children to, right, to visit these right. other witchy people who were all good witches.
Yes.
There were really no evil ones. But she was such a character. She liked the way she looked, even though she was not such a beauty.
Yeah,
but
average,
yeah. But she really approved of herself.
Yes.
And was totally independent yeah. and strong and funny. And flawed. I mean, even as much as you liked her, you knew she was not as warm and fuzzy
right,
as you would
right,
want your nanny
right.
to be. But so, yeah, oh, I'm so glad that you liked it.
Yes.
I remember it so vividly. And I have this vivid memory of going to the movies and seeing it as a little girl and hating it.
It wasn't the same. It never is. Because your imagination is so much greater. Okay, my last question for you. You have been so involved in the Jewish community, from writing the guidelines of life cycles, but you've also opened up a mikvah. Tell us quickly about that and how that's coming along.
Okay. Well, 5 years ago, actually, we opened Mayim Chayim Living Waters Community Mikvah and Education Center, which is unlike any mikvah that's ever been built before. A mikvah is a ritual bath. It's one of the oldest Jewish rituals. Actually, people used to go into water to cleanse themselves spiritually before entering the temple in Jerusalem and to make offerings. The way that it's stayed part of Jewish life is that women have gone to the mikveh monthly to purify themselves prior to sexual relationships. And people, when they convert to Judaism, it's sort of the last step. And that's actually the source of baptism, is mikveh. It's something we share. Mikveh had sort of fallen off the table for most American Jews. It was not part of Jewish experience. But more people are converting to Judaism now than have probably since the beginning of the Common Era. And it's a remarkable decision to make, and it seemed to me very clear that it should be afforded beauty and honor and respect. So we built a really beautiful, clean, inspiring, peaceful place. Mm-hmm. And people come for traditional purposes, and also people come to mark other transitions in their lives. So people come after chemotherapy. So people have come after divorce. People have come upon becoming physicians.
Whenever they want to be born again, so to speak.
It's a transition, and that's what it's all about.
Historically, the water that they're immersed in is supposed to be living waters.
Right.
Yet you have found a way to make that still applicable in your mikvah, even though you have to basically use distilled water for the most part.
Well, no. It's actually, and this has been true for, unless you live in Southern California or Hawaii, where you can go into the ocean because that's a natural body of water, you have to bring it inside. So we use rainwater. We collect rainwater from the roof into a pool, and all it takes is a symbolic little kiss of the rainwater into treated, heated tap water.
So like a cup of the rainwater into the tank.
Every day, and that turns it into a mikveh. Mm-hmm. It's a symbolic thing.
Well, I really admire what you're doing.
Well, thank you. Thanks for asking about that.
It's so helpful. I'm learning so much about the Jewish culture, which I'm loving too. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you so much, Anita, for being with me today. Anita Diamond's latest book is Day After Night. To learn more about the books and authors featured on Between the Lines, go to our website at wabe.org/BTL and listen to an archived program. Or check out our suggested reading list for both children and adults. To subscribe to a podcast of the program, go to our website and click on Podcast. Be sure to join us next week for another engaging program, because there's always more to learn when you go Between the Lines. The executive producer of this program is Louis Reitzes. Producer, Marjorie Lancer. Editor and technical producer, Mike Johns. Assistant producer, Colin Baylor. Opening and closing music by Afro Blue. And I'm your host, Valerie Jackson. Between the Lines is a production of 90.1 WABE.